Let's get started. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Okay, it's really great to be back again. I was only here about 2 months ago. And I did a book review on two books then, on Kindfulness by Ajahn Brahm and on this book by Aya Kama. And I was asked to come back and do a full session on Aya Kama's book. So apparently there was a few requests for that. So I'm very happy to come back and talk about this book. So it's Being Nobody, Going Nowhere by Aya Kama. And it's published by Wisdom. And I think it's around, let me just let you know. So it's in 1987 and then 2006, I think that was a second edition. And it has, let's see, about 174 pages. Just before I start, hands up who has read the book. Okay, one, yay. Okay, thank you, Aurora. Okay. So you have a lot of questions coming your way. Okay. So let me do a little introduction. So just, I am Venerable Metta Vihari. And I've been in the monastery now for about 2.5 years, and I'm really overjoyed to be a monk at Bodhinyana. Now the book is I came as a very interesting person, and I'm very happy to have had the opportunity to learn about her when I was preparing for this book review. And I thought a good way to start would be just briefly to talk a little bit about her. Who was Aya Kama, as a good introduction to this session? Very interesting person, and I have the foreword of this book. It's a lovely little foreword by Norman Fisher. I think he might be a Western Zen teacher, but it's a really, really endearing, intimate portrait he's written about Aya Kama. And I have selected a little passage to read out, and I've asked somebody to read it out. Can we have the mic, please? Thank you. And yeah, the man at the front there, man with the robe. Okay, when you're ready, please go ahead. Yeah. Thank you.
Foreword. Aya Kama was a very unlikely person. A round little woman with a large-featured face topped with a carpet of close-cropped, snow-white hair, she embodied naturally and oddly all the contradictions of the 20th century. She was an internationally renowned Buddhist teacher and also a Jew who fled Nazi Germany. She was a San Diego housewife and grandmother and also the founder of Dharma centers on several continents. She was a wandering, hippie, vegetarian mum who had travelled all over the world in her Land Rover. But she was also one of the few fully ordained Western Buddhist nuns and wrote scores of books on Buddhist meditation. Aya was never murky. She was definite, clear, precise, discriminating, and she had very little patience for anything extra. I think she felt she did not have the time for it. Certainly, she had no interest. Having seen and suffered as much as she had, with such a cheerful and enduring spirit, she just wanted to get on with things. She always cut to the chase, without whining or poetic elaboration. Her teaching was pungent and to the point, as this book attests.
Thank you, Venerable. I think that's a good summary, and it reflects how I feel about Ayakama after having read this book and also having read some of her other books and listened to some of her talks. I think what I feel is that she must... I get the feeling that she was quite a dynamic, powerful teacher, confident, very quite articulate, and direct, clear, and practical. And I also get the feeling that she's on task. So when you read her book, you get the feeling that she's telling you how to do meditation, and you feel like now's the time to get on and do the meditation, and you've got no time to lose. You know, we've got to get on and do it. And the book, as an overview of the book, she is really best known as being a meditation teacher. And that's what comes through in this book. There are four full chapters on meditation. But the other thing that she does a lot of is loving kindness and metta. So there are three full chapters on loving kindness. And the other thing that's really notable about her teaching is that just about everything she says comes from the Dhamma and from the suttas. So, and she's quite impressive in how much, how knowledgeable she is, and she uses the Dhamma to structure her teaching. And you can tell that by looking at the chapters. So apart from those chapters on the meditation chapters and the chapters on loving kindness, most of the other chapters are all about traditional teachings of the Buddha that you can read, that you learn reading the suttas. For example, you've got it's actually five full chapters on kind of like teaching topics, really important topics about Buddhism. So you've got like the five hindrances. That's chapter 6. Chapter 7 is karma and rebirth. Chapter 9 is the four kinds of happiness. Chapter 10 is the five aggregates. Chapter 11 is the 10 virtues or the 10 perfections. Chapter 12 is the four noble truths and the noble eightfold path. So in that way, this book would be quite good for somebody who's wants to get a good overview of all the important Dharma from Buddhism, what they need to understand, all the important concepts and topics. So that's really good, but on the other hand, she writes in a lot of... She speaks in a lot of detail as well, and her discussions are quite in-depth. So I think it could be good for advanced people who are quite already practicing for many years that could still get a lot out of this book. So... Did you find it a difficult... Aurora, did you find this a difficult book to read? Yeah? Okay. And did it give you some good advice about meditation? Did any tips? What did you find helpful or useful? All right, thank you. So let's get into today. What I wanted to do was to really focus on meditation, because she is really famous as a meditation teacher. My last book review, which I did 2 or 3 months ago, I already talked about, in a bit of detail, about what she wrote about loving kindness. So that's why I thought I'd kind of dealt with that. So I'm going to focus today on meditation, and I think that's where she's got a lot to teach us. She makes it very clear that meditation is very important. And like I said before, she says that, like, the steps are simple, but you have to work hard and you have to get down and do meditation. And like here, I've just pulled out a few phrases. On page one, she says, "There's no other way to learn to live each moment except by meditation." And then on page two, she says, "Only the meditator looks after the mind." And on page three, she says, "These are the main reasons why life can never be fulfilling without meditation." So the first chapter, she's talking a lot about how important the mind is, and how people often, they look after their body. They spend so much time kind of caring for their body, but they don't spend the time doing the same for their mind. She says people need to look after their mind the same way they look after their own body. And she says the way you can look after your mind is by meditation. So her method that she teaches is mindfulness of breathing. So that's quite a common method, but she has her own unique way of teaching that. She gets people to focus on the in and out breath, and she says that she often says, calm is the means, insight is the end. So chapter three is called Calm versus Insight. And I think this is one of the distinctive things about her meditation, teaching of meditation, is the way she tries to balance having a calm mind and with understanding. First you calm your mind, and then on the other side, it's important to learn more about your mind, understand it, and like that. So the interesting thing is that she actually, in her teaching, she gives people different ways of doing things. And I think this is quite a good thing for a teacher, because people are all a little bit different. And so even though she recommends following the in and out breath at the nostrils, which is a very common method of meditation, but she gives people other options. So let's see. So she says you can also counting. So counting 1, 2, 1, 2. Also, you can follow the breath as far in and as far out as possible. Another one is saying Buddha on the in-breath Buddha on the out-breath. Buddha, Buddha. And she even says that if you practiced attention on the rise and fall of the abdomen, then you can do that if that's a way you like to do it. So she's very flexible in that way. Even though she recommends kind of the following the breath at the nostrils, but she allows people to choose their own method of following the breath and of using mindfulness. So, going back to what I said before, calm, that's her kind of thing. Calm is the means, insight is the end. She says that on over and over. And Ayakama is very well known for teaching a meditation that leads to deep states of meditative calm. Meditative absorptions, they're sometimes called, or jhanas. These are deep states of meditative absorption, and they are things that I think a lot of people talk about, but maybe not so many people experience them. But the idea about Ayakama is, she says, it's simple. And she teaches these states of absorption. In chapter 9, she talks about it specifically. But in this book, she doesn't really go into so much detail about those advanced stages of meditation. So this, I think, in terms of meditation, this book is more for people who are not so advanced and are still learning to develop meditation and learning to just develop concentration. And I think some of her other books go into more detail on the more advanced meditation, getting into those four jhanas. In fact, she teaches not only the four jhanas, but also what are called the four immaterial attainments, which are sometimes called the higher four jhanas. But like I said, that's really her in this book. She's focusing more on developing the ability to have mindfulness of breath. So, having said that, there's another theme that runs through her teaching of meditation, and it's quite interesting, because she, even though she's teaching mindfulness of the breath, we all know when we meditate, sometimes that we have, it's difficult to stay on our breath or stay on the object of concentration. And what happens when you're meditating and suddenly you start thinking about, your mind starts getting involved, you thinking about what you're going to do at work tomorrow, or you need to go shopping, or thinking about something that happened last week, a problem you had with somebody. And then sometimes you have feelings that pop up, you know, like maybe you have some feelings that you're dealing with, some feelings of anger, or sadness, grief, or thinking about something that you're attracted to, a person you're attracted to, all these things can come in and interrupt the meditation. So what do you do when that happens? Okay. If you were just teaching very strict calmness meditation, you would say probably just drop the thought, let go of the feeling and come back to your breathing. So use that focus point of the breath and just come back to that focus point. But there's something interesting about her method, and I'm going to read a little short passage from page 25, which will introduce this. So this is at the bottom of page 25. All these steps, here we'll start with the next sentence. Every moment can be used to gain insight, and from that calm arises. A bit of insight creates a bit of calm. When we see that we don't need to pay any attention to our thoughts, it becomes easier to drop them. When we see that we don't have to react to feelings, it is much easier to drop the reaction. A bit of calm also creates a bit of insight, and both have to be used. So she's saying that you need to get a good balance between calm and insight. And so instead of just dropping the, for example, let's start with thinking. So your mind is racing or you're getting distracted. You can't stay on the breath. It's finding it difficult to concentrate. Well, what she teaches when that happens is labelling the thought. So she says, on page 7, she says, the way to work with that is to quickly label the thought. But if that is too difficult, just call it thinking, or confusion, or remembering, or even planning, or nonsense. It doesn't matter. The minute you give it a label, you are stepping back to look at it. Any label during meditation means the thought needs to be dropped. So, yeah, that is really a technique that she emphasises. If you're finding it difficult to stay on the breath, you're having these thoughts, take a moment to label the thought, and then that process of labelling it is kind of creating a separation, and that makes it easier to drop the thought. But if your thoughts keep coming back again and again, you just keep labelling the thoughts and keep practising that method of doing it like that. And the other thing that she talks a lot about is when you have pain and discomfort, when you're sitting down to meditate and you have pain and discomfort in your body, does that ever happen to you? You feel like kind of, oh, I've got a sore leg or neck or arm or whatever. Yeah, that's quite a common problem. And so she also says that is a learning opportunity. When your body is hurting, you're sitting there, use that as an opportunity to create a bit of insight. So on page 9, she says, when you get some problem with your body, watch the sequence: contact, feeling, reaction. Okay, so it's like the contact is some, you get some like sensory input, and then you get a feeling. In this case, an unpleasant feeling of discomfort or pain. Then she says, then you say, this is pain, I want to get away from it. So that's the reaction, right? You're reacting to the discomfort, the pain. So she says, instead of trying to get away from it, put your full attention on the spot where the feeling is and become aware of its changing nature. The feeling will either change its location or its intensity. Learn these lessons from the unpleasant feeling and then move if necessary. But don't move spontaneously. Move only after having examined why you're doing it. So she's really saying that that's a really valuable practice, is to use those painful feelings in your body to generate insight. She says you can know when you have these pains, it teaches you that this body consists of suffering. Know the impermanence, know the unsatisfactoriness, which is inherent in the human body. And what she's referring to there is one of the, probably really important teachings of the Buddha, and that is about the three characteristics, I call it, or the three marks of existence, and that is understanding the nature of the world is impermanence. Everything by its nature is impermanent. Second is suffering or unsatisfactoriness, because if something's impermanent and we are attached to it, then we suffer, then we experience some pain. And the third mark of existence is, she often calls it callousness or non-self. We have no control over it. And it's like it doesn't exist from its own side. Everything is caused by other causes and conditions. So this is one of these really important things that she teaches, and it shows to me the way that her teaching is pure Dhamma. It really is like everything is she teaches is Dhamma. It's traditional Buddhism, but she certainly has a certain emphasis. But on page 21, she talks about thoughts are very impermanent. They arise and they go. They don't stay, just like the breath. You can't keep any of those thoughts, can you? And then she says, all the thoughts that arise in meditation will give us an insight into ourselves, into the impermanence of this phenomenon, of body and mind, into the non-ownership of it. If we really owned our thoughts, why wouldn't we own something that was worth happening, that was worth having? Nobody likes to own rubbish. All of us try to make our possessions worthwhile. In meditation, the thoughts are found to be not worthwhile. She talks about this a lot, about thoughts are not very, you know, usually they're sending us, giving us a lot of kind of problems, and we need to learn to let go of them. Then she says, the third aspect we can learn from all that thinking is that this is dukkha. Dukkha doesn't only mean suffering, it also means unsatisfactoriness. The unsatisfactoriness of our thinking process becomes very, very clear during meditation, because we actually want to concentrate, and yet here we are sitting and thinking. And one thing about Ikaema, this is obviously an edited version of her talks. This book, I think most, if not all, of her books are Dharma talks that have been edited into book form. But she's very articulate, and she's perceptive. I think she really explains a lot of these ideas very, very well. And so that is kind of a little bit of a feeling for her basic method of teaching meditation. Now, by the way, if anyone has any questions, feel free at any time to put your hand up, and I'm happy to take questions at any time. Does anyone have any questions at the moment? Okay, we'll go on. I'll go on then. So, the next major topic is, and I can see as usual, I'm going to run out of time again. I always think I'm going to have not enough to say, and then I always run out of time. So, here we go. The next topic I want to talk about is, which is a really major topic, and that is the five hindrances. And this is another one of the classic teachings of the Buddha about the things that, more detailed treatment of the things that our mental states that prevent us from looking at things clearly and prevent us from getting an effective meditation. And she's got a long chapter on the five hindrances. And as we all know, meditation is not easy, and we always have, sometimes we have problems coming up, and we need to have strategies to know how to handle problems when we're meditating. So the five hindrances are, the Buddha talks about this five hindrances: sensual desire, ill will, dullness and drowsiness. I think that's also called sloth and torpor. There's also restlessness and worry, or sometimes people like say that restlessness and remorse is another name for that. And the fifth hindrance is doubt or skeptical doubt. I'm going to just quickly talk about the first two of those hindrances, because they are generally considered to be the most problematic ones, the ones that cause the most problems. So the first one is sensual desire. So sometimes we sit down, and then we want to meditate, and then we start thinking about all sorts of things that are nice. We'd rather think about some pleasurable sensation rather than meditate. So could be anything, could be like chocolate cake, could be your boyfriend or your girlfriend, could be going to the movies, could be anything. But the thing is, that's coming up when you're trying to meditate. So Ayakama gives advice on that. She says, what we can do is, what do we do when we have sensual desire and we're meditating? Okay, so first of all, she says, it's important to understand that sensual desire is an enemy. It creates fear that we may not get what we want, and enmity towards those who are getting what we want. And she says, the comfort we lack in the sitting position gives a wonderful opportunity to learn about sensual desires. Actually, there's two sides to that, because she talks about the joy that you can get when you're doing meditation. So that's the other side. If you're having good meditation, she talks about the joy and bliss that sometimes you can feel, and that can actually be, you need to be very careful that you don't get too attached to the joy and pleasure of meditation, because that's, you need to use it for, there's a danger of getting attached to the pleasant feeling that you're getting. And it's the same thing with the pain or discomfort as well. So they're just two sides of the same coin. And then she says, one of the things the Buddha advocated as an antidote to sensual desire is moderation in eating. So moderation in eating doesn't mean eating enough. It's eating enough to keep the body healthy. This is a sensual desire that's easily gratified and one that arises again and again. If we are able to put up a fence against one of our desires, we are going to be able to put up a fence against some more. Okay, and the next one is, seeing the body. Okay, another antidote the Buddha advocated is not seeing the whole but seeing its parts. And she's talking about the meditation on the 32 parts of the body. So when you have sensual desire, especially when it's you're attracted to another person, everyone has this feeling. And so one of the traditional methods for dealing with that is to go through a list of 32 parts of the body and take each part one by one, and look at each part, and you start off just with a simple thing like the skin, hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, and then you get more and more detailed and you go from the outside of the body to the inside. And then you start looking at, you know, the kidneys, the organs, heart, liver, membranes, and then you get progressively more gory or yucky. You go into like gorge, dung, bile, phlegm, blood, sweat, and so on. So that is another method for dealing with it. She says, if you feel strong desire for a person, instead of seeing the whole beautiful form of that person, remember that this human being is made up of many small parts. Okay. So instead of becoming entranced with the outer shape, form and colour, which are only the gift wrapping. So that is another method. And then she tells her story, and I don't have time to tell the story. I was... because we're running out of time. She tells a lovely little story there on page 54. And then there's another, what she calls antidote, and she says this antidote is the same for all five hindrances, and that is to have noble friends and noble conversation. And that's a very common advice she gives. She says, to have the kind of friends with whom one discusses not gossip, not the weather, not politics, not other people, but the way of emancipation through Dhamma. Those friends are the important people in one's life. When Ananda, the Buddha's cousin and attendant, once said to the Buddha, "Sir, a good friend is half of the holy life," the Buddha said, "Do not say so, Ananda. A good friend is the whole of the holy life." So Ayakama says, there is nothing to take the place of a spiritual friend. This is the most important person in one's life, the kind of friend who helps one remember to be on the path of practice. Okay, so then I'm just going to briefly talk about the second hindrance now, which is ill will. So that's when you have some kind of anger, irritation, frustration, any kind of negative mental states. You're upset with something or at someone, and that's coming up when you're meditating. So she gives quite a lot of good advice about this problem. She says, firstly, remember when anger arises, the Buddha said one of the first things to remember when anger arises is, I am the owner of my kamma. Such recollections are important. I'm the owner of my kamma, so when I'm getting angry, obviously, I'm going to get the result of that. Whether or not the other person has done anything to justify your anger has nothing to do with it. That's a common theme. She always says, no matter what happens in the world, it's up to you to handle your reaction. It's always about your reaction to something. It's just the way you have to learn to take responsibility for your own reactions to the problems that happen in your life. And she's quite strict about that. Then she tells a story of Kuntivardhan, the teacher of patience. That's a lovely story. It's a longish story. So it's pages 58 and 59. I won't be able to tell it to you, but if you've got the book, you can read that. Then she says, so remember that if you have anger, realize anger is useless. It makes one unhappy. It makes others unhappy. Not only that, it also makes a groove in the mind so that anger arises more and more easily. Then she says, we can look at the person we're angry with and try to remember something nice that that person has said or done. So you're training the mind to look at, trying to turn the mind around to look at, not be getting upset about something. You're trying to train the mind to look, have gratitude and to look for the good things about something or someone. Then she says, if we're already too angry to think anything good of that person, then remember that only an unhappy person acts in a nasty way. They're suffering. Have some compassion for the other person's suffering, whether they have a physical ailment or whether they're suffering from never having heard Dhamma. One doesn't know what may be the cause. It doesn't matter. Have compassion for that person. Okay, and then she says, if we're so angry, we can't remember anything good about the person and we can't think about their suffering, all those things are too difficult, then we can try to feel like a mother toward them. She says, that person's mother surely loves him or her. If we have any understanding of the Buddha's words, as the loving kindness discourse proclaims, we can remember that person's mother who certainly feels love toward her child and try to arouse a motherly feeling in ourselves. And of course she says, all these changes in the mind bring results, but it will take a while to be successful every time. Okay, so this brings me into the next topic, which I'm going to be kind of be the final topic for today's talk, and that is the other side of Ayakama's teaching, apart from teaching mindfulness of breathing and calmness meditation, is loving kindness. It's her other big theme of her teaching. She teaches it. She always teaches, on one hand there's breath meditation, on the other hand there is loving kindness meditation and loving kindness conduct. And she often talks about having balance between heart and mind. So she says, this is true for loving kindness. The word is meaningless. Only when you feel it flowing from your own heart will you get an idea what the Buddha talked about. Life cannot be lived fully unless it's lived with both heart and mind. The mind has its rightful place. One has also to understand what is happening. Yet if one only understands well, one may be intellectually advanced, but the heart is not engaged. Both must go hand in hand, heart and mind together. One has to understand and one has to use one's emotions positively. Emotions that are fulfilling and bring a feeling of peacefulness and harmony to one's own heart. And her this section of the book, chapter 4, she goes through the four immeasurable minds or the four Brahma Viharas. These are the they're kind of the divine abidings. Yeah, that's right. And she's got a great discussion on loving kindness. And then she talks about other similar qualities like compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And then she has a full chapter on the Metta Sutta, the loving kindness, the discourse on loving kindness. And that's a very famous sutta that is chanted very, very often in the monastery and in different ceremonies in Buddhism. It's a very beautiful sutta, and she's got a whole chapter on that. And she goes through that sutta line by line and discusses it. But what I want to finish on is the other thing that I think she does really well, and that is loving kindness meditation, guided meditation. So chapter 5 is a guided meditation. And I thought rather than talk about it, because she was saying herself, it's important to feel it. You've got to develop a feeling. It's got to come from the heart. When you're trying to cultivate unconditional loving kindness, it's got to come from the heart. You've got to feel it. So I thought the best way to let everyone get a feeling for what that's like is to play a short clip that I found of Aya Khema giving a loving kindness meditation. She's got many different varieties. Some focus on loving kindness, some on compassion, some on being your best friend, some on just like caring for yourself and other people. So what I'd like to do is play that. It'll go for a few minutes and let everyone have a listen to what it's like to do a loving kindness meditation with Aya Khema. Thank you.
Please put the attention on the breath for just a few moments. Look into your mouth and see whether there's any anger, envy, dislike, rejection, worry, pride, ill will. If you find any of these or anything else that causes unhappiness and restlessness, let these feelings and emotions float away like black clouds that are being dispersed by the wind. They are nothing but black clouds in the purity of the heart. Let them float away. And take another look into your heart and see the wide open expanse, space which is now ready to be filled with the warmth of love and the care of compassion. There's nothing to obstruct. All you have to do is fill it with that warmth, a huge open space in the heart. With compassion for yourself, for the difficulties you have had and are having, for the difficulty of being a human being, and empathy with yourself. Raise yourself with compassion. Fill yourself with the warmth of love. your attention on the 15 years. And realize that this person has exactly as much to pray as you have yourself. Give that person the gift of compassion, of empathy, of embracing that person with a compassionate heart. Feeling him on the other side. And surrounding him on the
Thank you. You can stop the recording now. Okay, and then that was just like to give you a feeling for the meditation. But then she goes on to, she starts with, you start with yourself, and then when she's doing it in a group, then you do it to the person. You spread that metta, that loving kindness and compassion, to the person sitting next to you, and then you spread it out to everyone in the room. And then you take other people, like your parents, you fill them with peace and gratitude, people who are nearest and dearest. And then you can take your friends, do the same thing, send your loving kindness to your friends, open your heart to them. Then you go out further away from you, and you can think about your neighbours who live near you, people you meet at work or on the street, in the shops. Make them all your friends. And then you take someone for whom you have dislike. It gets harder as you go along. So the further you go, the harder it gets, because then you start off with people close, then you go to neutral, and then you come to people who you have problems with, or you dislike, or you find difficult, and then you try to send them loving kindness and compassion. And then she often finishes with thinking about people who are sick or in hospital, in prison, hungry, in war-torn countries. So there's kind of thinking about people who are in a lot of suffering. And then at the end, she comes back to yourself, and you come back to yourself at the end, and give your return your loving kindness to yourself again. But some of her other ones, she uses imagery, like a lotus flower opening up in your heart, and light, bright light, and other things. And she's got many different ways of doing that. So that is what I wanted to share with you today about this book. I found it a very powerful book, really great book. So I learnt a lot from it, and I found her this book to be, quite. I felt like I'd learned a lot from it, and I felt like it was really worthwhile reading. So now I'd just like to see if anyone has any questions or comments. I'll wait, see if anyone wants to ask any questions. Okay, nobody? Yeah. Okay, so it's Being Nobody, Going Nowhere by Aya Kama. Yep, okay. So I definitely recommend it. It's one of my favourite Dharma books that I've read, yeah. Okay. All right, so I think time is up, so let's finish up. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Thank you, everybody.